cooperative called Harum Alam that worked the Jovian moons. The gathering storm was hidden in a generations-old mine that was marked on the surveys as having been lost to collapse 15 years before. It had been an OPA smuggling base, and the plan was to leave it there for a few weeks while the Laconian security forces were on high alert. Which meant, in the meantime, the crew could take a little time off the ship. Drink, visit brothels, play gol-gol and handball and two-court football. Or fold up their legs on soft woven cushions, listen to flute and drum music from hidden speakers, and scoop up little bits of fungus pretending to be wheat flour and cubes of spiced beef that had never been a cow. Another advantage was that a little time on Callisto with civilians meant they could take the temperature of the system, see how everyone was reacting to the news of the underground's attack. It turned out the response wasn't what Alex had expected. "Nothing?" Casper said. Alex cycled through the news feeds again. Food production on Earth and Ganymede were up this quarter, easily matching the established projections. A group in the Krasnoyarsk-Sakha shared interest zone was petitioning for trade autonomy. The settlement on Navnangar was reporting the discovery of a massive underground crystal network, and a special scientific commission was being assembled to determine whether it was another alien artifact or something that had occurred naturally on the planet. The lead singer of Tuva, T-U-V-A, had sent nude photos of himself to an underage fan, and the authorities were investigating. The Laconian Science Directorate was reporting a potential breakthrough in the survey of dead systems, a massive green diamond that experts suspected might contain records that, if decoded, would spell out the history of the species that had created the Ring Gates. That two Laconian frigates and a freighter carrying a critically important political officer had been destroyed in Sol System was listed precisely nowhere. Or, at least nowhere he could see without searching the newsfeed indexes. And since Saba had it on good authority that Laconia was keeping a close eye on search terms, Alex was stuck browsing and hoping for something. Anything. But... "Nope," he agreed. "Nothing." Casper took a bit of bread and scooped up a bite of his tagine. "I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad one."
"When I was your age," Alex said, "it would have been on every feed. Earth and Mars would have had official responses, and there would have been 18 different mainline feeds analyzing every word they said from different perspectives. The Belt would have had 1,000 different pirate broadcasts, with at least 12 of them taking credit for it personally, and at least one saying it was all a Jesuit conspiracy."
Casper grinned. One of his eye teeth was a little yellowed. Alex had never noticed that before.
"Sounds like you miss it, Grandpa."
Alex looked up, questioning. Casper put on a comic frown and an exaggerated drawl.
"When I was your age, we had to make our own water from scratch every morning, and dinosaurs roamed Mariner Valley."
Alex felt a little stab of annoyance, but he pushed it back and laughed.
"There was some variety, at least."
He gestured toward the feed spooling through on the tabletop monitor.
"Everything on this feels like it's been vetted by the same bureaucrat on Luna. It's all got the same voice."
"Probably was."
"Yeah," Alex said, shutting it off. "It probably was."
Casper stretched like a cat waking up from a nap, then tapped the monitor. The news feeds vanished and the restaurant's interface popped up.
"We can split this," Alex said.
"You buy next time," Casper said.
"Anyway, not like it's real money, right?"
All the storm crew on Callisto had false identities, generated by the underground and slipped into the systems, including biometrics and bank accounts. It was an uncomfortable way to live, knowing that everything was brittle. Alex's fake records could all be exposed if the Laconian security system raised a red flag. He could spend tonight and then the rest of his life in a jail cell. Everything could fall apart at any moment, which, to be fair, had always been true.
It was just harder to forget now. I'm meeting some of the engineering crew down on the third level. There's a bar that has open mic comedy and half-price whiskey. Enough karaoke, and a pretty boy like me might even find someone to take him home tonight. Drink one for me, and don't make any mistakes you can't regret the next morning, Alex said, rising from his cushion. I've got some things of my own to do.
Fair enough, Casper said. See you when I see you.
They parted in the corridor. Casper headed for the passage leading deeper below the moon's surface, Alex off to the left and toward the docks and the coffin apartments for people on shore leave. People like him. He walked with his hands stuck deep in the flight suit pockets, his eyes on the ground ahead of him, avoiding eye contact with the people walking in the same halls. The passage came to a Y intersection with a brushed steel sculpture that didn't seem to know if it was a human or a transport shuttle. Above it, the ships and their berths were all listed. All but his. When Alex had been a boy back on Mars, his great-uncle Narendra had come to stay with his family for a week once, while his group home in Innis Shallows had been renovated. Alex still remembered his great-uncle walking through the corridors of Bunker Hill with a calm, bemused expression while he and Johnny Joe explained the fine points of the game they had been playing. Alex felt the same expression on his own face now. Maybe it was something that happened with every generation, this sense of displacement. It might be an artifact of the way human minds seemed to peg normal to whatever they'd experienced first, and then bristled at everything afterward that failed to match it closely enough. Or maybe the change that Laconia's conquest was ushering in was different in kind from what had come before. Either way, the Callisto shipyard didn't feel like Sol's system anymore, or at least not the one Alex knew. It felt like the first days of Laconian rule, the sense of fear and fragility, like a ringing in his ears that never went away. Amos used to say that everywhere was Baltimore. That wasn't true anymore. Now, everywhere was Medina. His coffin apartment was near the docks. It was one of the larger models, a little over a meter high so that he could sit up in it. The mattress was old, recycled crash couch gel, and the walls and ceiling were layered glass and mesh with lights embedded in them to create the illusion of space going out beyond the surface. Alex crawled in, closed the access door, and made himself comfortable. He had a couple of new entertainment feeds he'd been thinking about checking out. Over the years, he'd made himself an expert on neo-noir crime thrillers, and there had been work coming out of series even before the Laconian takeover that used Pilkey montage to do some interesting things. He wondered, though, if signing in through the coffin system would compromise him. If Laconia knew enough about Alex Kamal to put together the kind of movies he liked, the kind of food he ate, the way he walked, and whatever other data he'd left behind him to pierce the mask that Saba had given him. If he was too much himself, would it send security officers to his door? Did it make more sense to watch something popular and generic and stay at the center of the herd? He pulled up his profile on the coffin system. A red icon showed a private connection from the storm. There was a certain irony in the fact that he was more worried that Laconia would catch him out because he watched a certain kind of entertainment feed than he was that actual encrypted communications from the underground would give him away. But there it was. He'd made the decision to trust Saba's old OPA techs when he got into this business. Didn't make sense to start second-guessing them now. He opened the message, and his son looked back at him from the screen. Ada, Kit said with a grin that reminded him of Giselle. Kit looked more like his mother than like him, thank God. Weird to hear from you again so soon. Are you in system? I mean, don't tell me. I know we're all hush-hush, but hey, things are great this semester. I'm pulling top marks in three of my sections, and the smile turned rueful. I've got a good tutor for the other two. And so I'm dating this girl, and I think it's starting to look kind of serious.
Her name's Rohani. I haven't told her about, you, but if there ever gets to be a chance for you to come to meet her, Mom is talking to her family, and I think she may be your daughter-in-law pretty soon. So it would be good, yeah?
There was more to the message, and Alex listened to it with a warmth in his chest and a sorrow. He wasn't going to meet the girl. He wasn't going to attend the wedding, if there was one. Rohani would go on the list with Amos and Holden and Clarissa. Another loss. It was just another loss. He'd live with it. He had to. His hand terminal chimed, and an alert popped up from the false ID that Saba used for high-priority messages. With dread in his gut, he opened it. Be advised that the Tempest has broken orbit and is moving toward Jupiter.
Well, Alex said to himself, shit.
My little man's getting married? Bobby said, but she kept looking at the supply crates while she said it.
Girl will be lucky if I don't swoop in and carry him off first.
The warehouse was on the edge of the complex. It didn't use the station's power grid, and the environmental system was a retrofit from an old rock hopper. It left condensation on the walls and ceilings, water discoloration like leopard spots. The larger gear, like torpedoes, was still on the storm. But the smaller salvage from the Laconian freighter had been transferred onto four wide rows of pallets and moved to the warehouse. Bobby had unpacked them, scattering the storage crates through the space as she did her own private inventory. Scorch marks darkened some of the boxes. The chalky smell of ceramic that had been heated until it flaked hung in the air.
You're taking the news that the largest battleship in the Empire is heading toward us very calmly, Alex said.
She took a deep breath and kept her voice patient.
Jillian's getting word to everyone. The Tempest is days out, and this work needs to be done one way or the other. I'm hoping by the time I'm done with it, I'll have a plan.
How's that working for you?
Nothing so far. I'll let you know.
Alex sat on one of the boxes. He felt heavier than the gentle gravity of the moon could explain.
Bobby, what are we doing here?
She paused, looked over at him. She had a lot of different expressions, and he'd come to know most of them. He knew when he was talking to his friend and when she was the captain. Right now, she was listening to him as the woman he'd been on the Rosie with, back in the day. The one who had known him since before Io.
Fighting the enemy, she said. Degrading their ability to bring force and influence to bear. Denying them the use of resources.
Sure, Alex said. But to what end? I mean, are we trying to get back to the Transport Union running things, or are we trying to make it so that every planet is calling its own shots, and then seeing if it all works out?
Bobby crossed her arms and leaned against a stack of boxes. The work lights were harsh, and Alex could see all the roughness in her face and arms that decades of hard work and radiation had left. Age looked good on her. It looked right.
I'm hearing you ask whether authoritarianism is necessarily bad, she said. Did I get that right? Because yeah, it is.
That's not what I mean. It's just, I don't know what it is. I'm feeling overwhelmed. Maybe a little demoralized.
Yes, Bobby said. Yes, we are.
You too?
We lost the target. That political officer might have given us something that could break these fuckers back to the Stone Age. I mean, maybe not, but I'm not going to know now. So yeah, I'm a little grumpy. But I'm guessing that's not exactly what's biting you.
I don't know what the win looks like.
Well, for me it looks like dying with the knowledge that humanity's a little better off than it would have been if I'd never been born. A little freer. A little kinder. A little smarter. That the bullies and bastards and sadists got their teeth into a few less people because of me. That's gotta be enough.
Yeah, Alex said. But she kept going.
I'm not a grand strategy girl. That's for the eggheads. I'm a ground pounder. And I always will be. These people want every planet to be a prison where they get to pick who's the guard and who's the inmate.
And we're against that,
Alex said. He heard the exhaustion and agreement in his own voice.
You ever think Naomi's right? Maybe it's better to try getting inside the system? Changing it that way?
She is right, Bobby said, turning back to her inventory. It's just, I'm right too. Naomi wants there to be one way to fix this, and she wants it to be the one where there's no blood.
But there's two ways, Alex said, thinking that he was agreeing.
There's no way, Bobby said. There's just pushing back with everything we've got and hoping we can outlast the bastards.
You know we're on the clock here, Alex said. I'm thinking about Takeshi.
I sent a message to his people, Bobby said. It's always hard losing someone. And we'd been very lucky up to that point. It couldn't last.
I'm thinking that he was one of your best, and he was damn near 60. Jillian, Casper, and a few others aside, our resistance is made up of old belters, old OPA.
Agreed, Bobby said. And thank God for that. Most of them have a clue what they're doing.
Behind them is a whole new generation who were never in the OPA, never fought the interplanets for independence, who grew up fat and rich on transport union freighters with respect and important jobs, kids like Kit. How are you going to convince them to give up everything they've got and join this fight?
Bobby stopped and turned to look at him.
Alex, where's this coming from?
I think we have a resistance right now because we have a lot of old guys who grew up resisting an enemy too strong to ever beat. They've been inoculated against fear of failure. But when they're gone, I think we're done, as a movement, as a force in history. Because we're not going to convince anyone born after the Transport Union was formed to fight an unwinnable fight. And maybe in the long run, Naomi's plan to win politically is all we'll have left.
He saw Bobby's eyes go flat. Unwinnable fight? She said.
Well, Alex said, isn't it?
Chapter 12. Bobby. An unwinnable fight. Alex was gone, heading back to the storm to figure what exactly their evac options looked like, if they had any. What he'd said stayed after him. The temporary warehouse their OPA friends had found for them smelled like burnt ceramics and old ice. Bobby had been working in it long enough now that the smell didn't trigger a gag reflex, so that was sort of a win. She ticked off an entry on her supply list. 12 crates of Laconian fuel pellets. They'd been intended for the Tempest, but they'd work in the storm, too. And because the Laconian reactors seemed to want to use only their own brand of pellet, it meant her ship would get to keep flying for a while. Unless the Tempest shot them all to atoms. But the storm didn't have a lot of storage space. They'd need to make some decisions soon about how much of their stolen loot to carry with them and how much to hide or sell. Fuel, bullets, or food. The hierarchy of needs. Wartime edition. And now, with a Magnetar-class dreadnought heading in their direction, the importance of every decision was even greater. An unwinnable fight. Bobby had been at Medina Station when the Tempest came through the Laconia Gate for the very first time. She'd watched it use its primary weapon on the railgun defenses and turn them into spaghettified atoms in a single shot. And while she hadn't been part of the defense of Sol System when the Magnetar-class battlecruiser made its attack, she'd read the reports. The combined might of the Earth-Mars coalition hadn't even been able to slow the Tempest down. She had no illusions that their one destroyer stood a chance. Run and hide was their only option now. Alex had been a Navy boy for 20 years before he'd become the pilot of the Rosinante. He'd always been reliable under pressure. But something had happened when they met with Naomi this last time. Or maybe it was the idea of his kid getting married. Or maybe it was that he was a little smarter than she was, or a little less angry, or a little more realistic.
Maybe it was that he'd seen a little sooner than she had why the fight was unwinnable. The underground was held together with spit and baling wire even at the best of times. Saba did what he could to help the old OPA fighters keep the Laconians uncomfortable where they could. But the simple truth was that the storm was their only meaningful asset. The ship, and by extension her strike team, were the Resistance's only real weapon against Laconia. The Transport Union didn't have gunships, and the void cities had been disarmed as part of the treaty negotiations. The Earth-Mars Coalition fleets couldn't help even if they wanted to, now that they all had Laconian flag officers on them, reporting directly to Admiral Trejo. If Alex was losing heart, Bobby didn't believe for a second he was alone. The failure to capture the political officer, combined with the looming threat of the battleship, might be enough to get her crew wondering why they were still risking their necks, fighting an unbeatable foe. And as much as she disliked it, Alex was right. The old guard OPA attitude of resistance for resistance's sake would only keep them going so long. Part of what she should be doing was training up the next generation of fighters. Only so far, they weren't waiting in the wings to step in. Duarte and his people were smart. They kept things from getting bad too quickly. They made the right speeches about respect and autonomy. They let people believe that government by a king would never go wrong. And by the time it did, and things got bad enough to inspire a younger resistance, she and Alex and the old-school OPA would be off the board. Then, who would be left to fight? Why would they think there was any hope in it? Recruitment wasn't her job. It belonged to Saba, or Naomi, or one of the other secret leaders of the underground, but she couldn't stop thinking about it. Alex had opened the issue. Now it itched. Bobby finished her check of the fuel cell crates and moved on to something the manifest listed as sensor components. The team had grabbed it off the freighter because any repairs the storm needed were done in-house and on the fly. Spare parts were always at a premium. Inside the crate was a sealed gray ceramic box about the size of a toaster with 7 input ports on its side. Bobby used her terminal to look up the serial number on the case. It was listed as an active sensor array control node, the little processing station that coordinated data coming in from the radar and LADAR sensors, did first-level analysis, and acted as the hindbrain between the main computer and the sensors themselves. An expert pattern-matching system about as smart as a pigeon. If they were sending a new one to the Tempest, it might mean that they'd lost one in the fight for Sol. It was a nice idea, anyway, that the big dreadnought had taken some damage in the fight it couldn't just heal for itself. And it made sense. The weird hulls and reactors and engines of the ships might heal like the ship was a living thing, but they were protomolecule technology. The sensors and computers on the Laconian ships were human tech. Anything built by humans had to be hand-repaired or replaced. It was one of the few weaknesses of the hybrid ships. And if she had the replacement parts, it might mean there was a hole in the Tempest sensor package. If they could figure out where it existed, maybe they could get close to the big ship before detection. They could fire one meaningless torpedo before the big bastard swung around and ripped them into atoms, paint something rude on the hull, pee on it. Jillian's crack about moral victories was annoying, but that didn't make her wrong. Bobby put the sensor node back into its case and marked the box as one to definitely keep for themselves. An hour later, she'd finished going through the pallet of spare parts and tagged them all as keepers. Her terminal was playing a little three-dimensional game of fit all the loot. Every time she marked a crate, the program shuffled everything in the storm storage compartments, looking for a place to put it. At some point, they'd have to start storing things in the staterooms and hallways, and that point wasn't far off. She opened a crate of protein flavorings for the galley food processor and marked it, "Do not keep." She started to close it, then sighed and changed it to keep. The terminal played its little space-shuffling game. An army marches on its stomach, the ancient saying went, and people who were risking their lives for the cause should probably be able to have a tasty meal every now and then. It was interesting, though, that the Tempest was coming after them. It felt good to know she'd hit the enemy hard enough to sting. Maybe it was just pride. Admiral Trejo angry that a pirate would dare act in his solar system. Or maybe the political officer had been close enough to someone high in command that this was a personal vendetta now. Or maybe they just really wanted their protein flavoring back. Whatever it was about the raid that made Laconia jump, she hoped they were as bothered and itchy as she was. She reached the end of her row of pallets, which meant her work was half done. A few more hours digging through boxes, and she could sneak off to one of those old bars at the port and drink her troubles away, or at least distill them down to nausea and a hangover. And maybe she'd get a steak. She felt like Saba and the Resistance could afford to buy her a steak. Her stomach rumbled at the thought. So maybe she called it a day now, and came back to finish tomorrow. A small pile of high-impact crates had been set off to the side, away from the main rows of pallets. They had a variety of warning labels on them, so her crew had put some space between them and the rest of the supplies. All right. Go through the dangerous stuff now, then call it a day. The top crate in the pile had a caustic chemical warning and was filled with spray cans of degreaser. Not exactly a threat to life and limb. She moved the crate over to the regular supplies. Beneath it was a crate marked High Explosive that had reloads for the rocket launchers the Laconian power armor could attach. She marked that one as Definitely Keep and set it aside. Under that was a large metal crate. The label said Magnetic Containment Explosive Danger. That was odd. None of those words seemed to go together in a way that made sense to her. She checked the serial number on the side of the crate with her terminal, and it came back, ID not found. Curiouser and curiouser. Nothing on the crate indicated that opening the latches was hazardous, so Bobby popped them and lifted the lid. It was much heavier than it looked. Lead-lined, maybe. Inside, cradled by enough foam to keep a robin's egg intact during high-G maneuvers, were four metallic spheres, about the size of Bobby's two fists held together. All four had cables running to a massive power cell that gave off a low hum of high electricity. The power cell's indicator showed that it was at 83% charge. Each sphere had its own indicator where a cable from the power cell connected to it. They all showed 100%. Bobby very carefully lifted her hands away from the box and took a step back. Nothing in the box itself looked all that dangerous. Just four big metal balls and a high-capacity battery. But every hair on her body was standing straight up. It was all she could do to stop herself from running away. Bobby knelt back down next to the crate and very gingerly lifted one of the metal balls out, making sure to keep the cable connected to the power supply. Once it was out of its foam cradle, warning text could be seen. Ensure magnetic containment system remains charged. Danger of explosion, it said. Another, smaller warning read, Do not run on internal power supply for more than 20 minutes. The labels on it were from the Laconian Science Directorate. Not military, except that everything Laconian was military. Not usual ordnance, anyway. Nothing familiar. Bobby returned the sphere to its place in the foam and sat back. Something in the spheres exploded when it wasn't magnetically restrained. Fusion reactors work that way. The magnetic bottle held the fusion reaction suspended because nothing material could handle the heat of the core. These little spheres weren't reactors, though. A fusion reactor was huge. It required extensive support mechanisms to inject fuel pellets, compress and fuse those pellets, and turn the fusion reaction into electricity. The Laconians were advanced, but it didn't seem plausible that they were so advanced that they'd created fusion reactors a little bigger than a softball. And these things were using power, not generating it. She pulled out her terminal and called Rini Glodin. She was an old belter on the Storm, a high-energy physics PhD from way back in the days at Ceres Polytech, who'd gotten radicalized in college and spent a couple of decades in a UN prison after she started helping the Voltaire Collective build bombs. Now, she was the chief engineer and resident gearhead on the Storm. "Boss?" Rini said after a couple moments. She sounded sleepy, or drunk. "Catch you at a bad time?" "You can leave now," Rini said, but her voice was muffled, like she'd covered the mic with her hand. A minute later, "What is it?" "I have a weird question, but if you had company," Bobby said. "He's gone. He was pretty enough, but post-coital conversation was not his strong suit. What's going on?" "I'm going through the loot we pulled off that freighter," Bobby said, "and I found this crate of stuff I'm having a hard time identifying. Thought maybe you could help." "You're at that warehouse by the surface? Let me pull on some clothes and I'll get right down there." "No," Bobby said, "don't do that. I think this might be dangerous and I don't want anyone in here until I figure it out. Hold on, let me send you some video." Bobby passed her terminal across the crate, giving Rini a good look at the power cell and the spheres. Then she propped the terminal up against the edge so she could use both hands to pick up a sphere and show the warning text to the camera. When she was done, she said, "Any ideas?" There was a long pause. Bobby felt the unease rising in her like an illness. "Fuck me," Rini said at last. "What do you think it is?" "So, the big question about the Magnetar-class ships has always been power," Rini said. There was a lot of background noise as she spoke, drawers opening and closing, clothes being pulled on. She was dressing in a hurry. "The stars the ships are named after have incredible magnetic fields, but they're rapidly rotating neutron stars, so how do you get that beam effect the ships have without, you know, spinning up a neutron star?" "Okay," Bobby said. Her knowledge of astrophysics was pretty thin. "How do they?" "No one knows," Rini said. "But it would take way more power than a typical fusion reactor puts out. Everyone just sort of assumed that meant the Laconians had much better reactors than us. But we have the Storm, and our reactor is good, but its design is nothing paradigm-shifting." "I'm sitting right next to this thing while you talk," Bobby said. "So, go faster, maybe?" "Antimatter results in a 100% conversion of matter into energy. Nothing else even comes close. If the Laconians power their beam with antimatter, that actually makes sense." Bobby laughed. There was only a little mirth in it. "Am I sitting next to 4 bottles of antimatter, Rini?" "Maybe. I mean, the only way to contain it would be a magnetic field. If it touched anything, boom. So sure, maybe." "How much of that stuff do you think is in here?" "I don't know, a kilo? A gram of it would be a bomb big enough to level a city. Based on the size of those orbs, you've probably got enough there to punch a hole in this moon. I mean, if that's what's in there." "All right," Bobby said. "Thanks. I'll be in touch." "Fuck that, I'm on my way down there," Rini said, then killed the connection. At least Bobby understood now why the Tempest was treating this as high priority. Looking at the metal balls in their case was making Bobby's scalp crawl. And then, all at once, it wasn't. The fight had just changed, and she knew how to win. Chapter 13. Naomi.
"The question is," Saba said on Naomi's monitor, "why did they have a political officer in the first place, Keno?"
The Bikaji Kama was on the float, and still half a week from a gentle quarter-G braking burn that would take weeks before they reached the transfer station at Oberon. With the drives on the ship, they could have done a full G the whole way, but efficiency and speed weren't always the same thing. Carrying the reaction mass to accelerate and brake that hard would have meant giving up more of the cargo space. Maybe someday the Laconian technology would overcome the constraints of inertia. The protomolecule had been doing so since Eros, but for now that mystery was still a mystery, like so many others. Where did the ships that went Dutchman end up? What would draw the attention and anger of the thing that had destroyed the protomolecule engineers? Or, on a smaller level, why had a Laconian political officer been riding on a Transport Union freighter? News of the failure had been slow coming to her. The first report had been sketchy and brief, and said little more than that the raid had gone pear-shaped. Political officer, the informants on the freighter, and one member of the assault team lost. The next 34 hours had been a thin slice of hell as she waited for the full after-action report, certain beyond doubt that Bobby had been the one who died. Only it hadn't been her. One of her crew was dead, and her mission objective had slipped through her fingers, but Bobby and Alex and the gathering storm lived to fight another day. The death of the political officer was just one of the stupid, random tragedies that happened anywhere, any time, but significantly more often during battle. If he'd lived, they'd know much more about what he'd been doing. As it was, they were down to educated guesses.
"We have confirmation that he was on his way to the Transport Union's transfer station at Earth," Saba said. "But whether that was a permanent placement or a stop along a longer path," he shrugged eloquently. Naomi stretched. She liked the freedom of free fall, even though it meant doubling up her exercise routine. Or maybe because it meant that. More hours in the resistance band meant at least doing something physical, feeling her body. And also there was a sense of being where she belonged. From the recording, she could tell that Saba was someplace with a steady gravity. The last four communications from him had all been the same, so a spin station or a mass large enough to hold him down. No one was on a steady burn for that long. It wasn't really a surprise that something was happening on Earth important enough to warrant a dedicated representative at the transfer station. Apart from Sol's permanent role as humanity's original home, it was still the largest population center in the Gate Network, and Earth had the largest population of any planet. Even with settlements like Oberon and Baragaun complex growing, there would never be enough ships or shipping to make a dent in the billions still left on Earth. But what exactly was on Winston Duarte's mind about Sol's system was an important question, and one that they could have answered if luck had broken their way just a little bit more. She considered, rubbed her eyes, and hit record. She'd edit her response down before she committed it to a torpedo, but just saying the words helped her think, and she could pretend she wasn't quite as isolated and alone as she was. "The loss of our informants on the ship is going to be important," she said. "Without them, we wouldn't have known that the political officer was there in the first place. And if they hadn't spoken up, they'd still be alive. Not the best argument for working with us. Their families need to be taken care of. And by us. Not Duarte's people. Otherwise, we'll see fewer of these tips in the future."
"It's always about relationships," Jim said in her imagination. "It's always about relationships," she said. "And we have to hold up our end of the bargain. Take care of our own. To the other point, if we're going to find what Duarte's doing there, we need to get one of ours on the transfer station. Either find someone already on staff sympathetic enough to feed us information, or someone who can be inserted into the administration. Trying to get the storm to intercept another freighter is too high a risk." But she thought it was possible that someone from the storm could act as an agent of the underground on TSL-5. She wondered if Bobby would go. Part of her thought she would. It was the dangerous assignment, after all. But Naomi also couldn't quite imagine her giving up command of the storm, even for something important. But She was getting ahead of herself. Before we take any direct action, we should finish a full inventory of what was on the freighter. If there were any supplies or equipment on it that were out of the ordinary, that might... Her system threw out an alert, and Naomi's heart leaped despite her better judgment. It was a new message from Jim. Duarte had been doing this almost since Jim had been taken to Laconia. Not quite public announcements, though there had been some of those too. Broadcasts sent out and picked up on passive with an old, compromised encryption scheme. Someone would have to want to know what was in them, anyway. The security wasn't the issue so much as a signature, an address. Here was a message that Laconia could spread through every system in the gate network, but only she could watch it. Or only she and the Rossi. Or someone else who'd taken the time to crack the Rossi's old codes. It was a private message, then, between Jim and her and every high-end government censor on Laconia. She had a vague memory about nobility on old Earth, having witnesses on important wedding nights to watch the newlyweds fuck. This felt about as dignified. And still, there was nothing under any sun that would keep her from playing it. The message began with the blue wing-shaped crest of the Laconian Empire, a test tone, and then there he was. Jim looking into the camera with a mild amusement that most people wouldn't recognize as a variety of rage. He had on a colorless shirt, and his hair was combed enough to show where his hairline was starting to pull back a little. Anti-aging regimens had pushed human life from the 3 to 4 decade range of prehistory to 4 times that, but wear and tear still counted for something. Jim had suffered more than his fair share of punishing life experiences, and then the fake grin ended, and he really smiled, and the decades fell away. Even before he spoke, she heard him. The mix of sorrow and amusement in his eyes, like a guest at a party that had gone so wrong that the travesty had lapped itself and become a little bit fun again. She stopped the playback as he opened his lips and took the moment with him. Even just the picture of him. Then, steeling herself, she started the message. "Hey there, Knuckles. Sorry it's been so long this time, but things got a little busy over here. I'm guessing you heard about Avasarala? The funeral brought in a lot of other guests to the palace." Using the nickname Knuckles, which he never had when they were together, was the signal that he knew they were still hunting her. She also heard the ghost of sarcasm in the way he said guests, but the censors hadn't. There were real challenges to controlling communication between two people who'd been intimate for as long as she and Jim had been. The private language between them couldn't be perceived by bureaucrats, and what couldn't be seen couldn't be stopped. The story of her life these days. "There's still not much I can say. You know how it is. I met the guys who actually review this before it goes out. So, hey Mark. Hey Chano. Hope you guys are having a good day too. But yeah, things are fine here. Some rain in the afternoon, and Laconia's getting on toward what passes for midsummer. They're letting me have a lot of access to the grounds, and I'm catching up on my reading. Mark and Chano say I can't talk about what I'm reading in particular, but it's nice to have access. I'm also watching the news feeds and the things that Duarte, they want me to call him High Consul Duarte, but really it seems pretentious. Anyway, the work he's doing about figuring out the gates and what happened to the protomolecule engineers is actually pretty impressive. We disagree on other things, but he's on the job with that, which, you know, hopefully. But I hope you're okay. Give the kids my fond regards, and I'll send you another message as soon as Mark and Chano have an open slot in their schedule. They're good guys. You'd like them. I love you." The image cut to blue, and Naomi let out her breath. It always hurt to see him, and the kids meant Alex and Bobby and Amos. He had no way to know Amos was lost to them, probably killed on the same planet where Jim was being held prisoner, or that Bobby and Alex were off leading the fight on the front lines as pirates and revolutionaries. But even with all of that, hearing him always made her feel a little better, too. It was as near to proof of life as she'd get. He didn't look sick. He didn't sound like he was under duress. The image changed again, and a new face appeared, a man with dark eyes, acne-scarred skin, and a calm in his expression that landed him directly in the uncanny valley. Naomi found herself pulling back from the screen even before she realized who she was looking at. High Consul Winston Duarte, Emperor of 1300 worlds, smiled as if he'd seen her reaction and sympathized with it. "Naomi Nagata," he said, and his voice was pleasant and reedy. "I know I don't usually insert myself in these messages, and I hope you'll forgive me this rudeness. I don't mean to intrude, but I think we should talk, you and I. I want to extend an invitation to you. Contact any of my security people on any station or base or city, and I will have you brought safely here. I understand that you and your fellow partisans don't see eye to eye with me about the shape that humanity should take moving forward. Come talk to me. Convince me. I'm not an unreasonable man, and I'm not a cruel one. The truth is, over the last few years, Captain Holden and I have found we have much in common." Naomi chuckled despite herself. "Sure you did. You've seen how Holden is treated. If you come as my guest, you'll have all the same courtesies and comforts, and you'll have access that will let you advocate for the changes you want without the violence and death. I know we haven't met, but everything Holden has told me says you're more than some old-fashioned anti-government extremist. He believes in you, and he has convinced me to believe in you, too. Accept my offer, and you and Holden can be eating breakfast together before you know it. He'll tell you himself I'm a decent host." He made a self-deprecating smile. Carrot done, Naomi thought. Now stick. "If you choose not to, that is your right. But as an enemy of the state, the consequences will be less pleasant. It's going to be better for you and for me and, excuse me if this sounds grandiose, for the whole of humanity if you come as a guest. Please at least consider the option. Thank you." The message ended. Naomi shook her head once, tightly, and held on to her anger like it was a vaccine against something worse. Whether Duarte said it or not, the offer included trading all she knew of Saba and the underground. In return, she would be waking up next to Jim, living in a prison 1,000 times larger than the one she'd imposed on herself. That was all obvious. The poison was the rest of it. Access, influence, the Emperor's ear. It was exactly the path she'd argued for. Working within the system to make a revolution without starvation and hatred and dead kids. He was offering it to her on a plate. And it was possible, just possible, that he was even sincere. Everything Saba had learned through his sources said that Jim really was being treated well, a guest as much as a prisoner. That was the cheese in the mousetrap. It was cunning almost to the point of wisdom. If she believed in her heart that Duarte would break his word, it would have been 1,000 times easier to reject him. But all the stories about the devil making a deal and then cheating missed the point. The real horror was that once the bargain was struck, the devil didn't cheat. He gave you exactly and explicitly all that had been promised. And the price was your soul. The knock startled her. It was like something from a different world. A moment ago, she'd been on Laconia. Eden, complete with a snake. And now she was back in her box, floating a few centimeters above the gel of her couch, the straps drifting around her like seaweed wrapping the drowned. She shifted her monitor to show the exterior of the container, half afraid to see the Bikaji Kama's security chief ready to take her in, half hoping. The woman outside gripped a handhold and looked straight into the hidden camera. A black zippered duffel floated beside her. She was heavy-set, with gray-streaked hair pulled back into a harsh bun and dark skin that got darker around her eye sockets, like she'd cried too long and it had stained her. Naomi recognized her as Saba's agent on the ship, but didn't know her name. Naomi pushed off from the crash couch, drifting fast toward the far end. She landed feet first, absorbing her momentum with her knees, and tapped her security code into the mechanism. The mag bolts clacked. In the silence, they sounded like gunshots. Before Naomi could open the door, the other woman did. She slid through, pulling the black bag with her, then shut the door behind her and glanced around the container as if there might be something unexpected in it. "What's the matter?" Naomi asked. "Captain got a call middle of last shift," the woman said in a clipped accent that sounded European to Naomi. "Took me longer than it should have to get a copy. That's on me." She shoved the bag at Naomi. Even without opening it, the shape of mag boots and the hiss of a flight suit were unmistakable. Naomi didn't wait. She slid the zipper open and started pulling the uniform on over her own clothes while the woman talked. "Laconian destroyer burning in for a rendezvous. Should be here in 18 hours. Say they're going to make a full inspection, so Alisla." She gestured at Naomi's things. The home she'd made for herself. "Yeah, we're going to have to get clever about making that match the manifest." "Inspection?" "Full," the woman said. "This is all supposed to be bacterial samples. They see this." If they saw the false container, they'd know how the underground was staying hidden, and that some fraction of the transport union was in on the scheme. It might not be the end of the shell game, but it would be a data point too clear for Laconia to overlook for long. And it would be the end for her. "Is it only us?" Naomi asked. "Does it need to be more? Us is our problem. Focus on..." "No," Naomi snapped. "I got an offer of amnesty if I turned myself in. This, just after that? Are they coming for other ships, or do they already know I'm here?" The woman's face went gray. "Don't know. I can find out. Do it fast and get me a loader. I'll try to find a way to cover this over." "Yeah," the woman said. "And crew manifest. I got to put you in somehow." "Not the priority," Naomi said. "But," the woman said. Then, "Right. All right." Naomi looked around her container. It seemed sadder now that she had to leave it. She'd have to wipe the system just in case she was taken. All her belongings would have to go, too. She'd be starting over from nothing again. Or she could go to the security office, announce herself, and spend the rest of her life waking up next to Jim, eating real food, maybe even talking Duarte into a better, kinder, less authoritarian future for all of humanity. If it was a trap, it was a good one. Offer her an out, make the threat, and then tighten the screws. If she'd been younger, it might have been enough to panic her. Convince her to announce herself. Sign the deal. It would be easy, and she could even tell herself that she was protecting the underground and the people like the woman before her. She'd only tell Duarte things that wouldn't compromise Saba and their network, that wouldn't threaten Bobby and Alex and the storm. She could imagine the version of herself that would have been able to do it, not so different from who she was now. Younger, that was all. "Emma," the other woman said, "we're going to pass you for crew. You'll need to know names. I'm Emma Zomorodi. You can call me Naomi." "I know who you are," Emma said. "Find me someone who doesn't." The woman, Emma, looked at her again, more closely, then turned away, shaking her head. The fear in her expression was thick enough to see. "It's okay," Naomi wanted to say. "I know what to do. It'll be all right." It would have been a lie.
Come on, Naomi said. We don't have time.
Chapter 14. Teresa.
Yes, Teresa said. I know. Okay, let me get ready.
Muskrat barked once as if she'd understood the words. Probably she had. Dogs could have broad functional vocabularies. It was a point Dr. Cortázar often made. The fact that humans were not the only conscious animals seemed very important to him. It had always seemed obvious to her. Teresa set her room to high privacy and sleep, dimming the lights and locking her doors. No one would disturb her now unless they were evacuating the state building. Muskrat wagged hard enough that her back legs looked unsteady as Teresa changed into the same simple tunic and pants she normally used for gardening. They had no technology, so they weren't connected to the palace network. She started up an entertainment feed on her system on low volume, as if she were dozing and watching an old Kaz Pratihari adventure. Her window had a sensor in the frame that alerted a security officer when it was opened, so Teresa had opened it every now and then over the course of weeks, trying different ways to get around it. Was it electronic? She tried keeping the window and the frame touching with a copper wire. Security still got their alert. Optical? She searched everywhere for anything resembling a pinhole camera or a light sensor, but never found one. Motion activated? She tried opening the window very slowly over the course of days, but on the fifth day, security got their alert. Not motion sensing. And it only went off when there was an 11-millimeter gap between window and frame. Interesting. It had turned out to be magnetic. A low-strength magnet in the window, when moved too far from a sensor in the frame, set off the alert. She'd solved this by using a plastic letter with a tiny magnet in it from her preschool alphabet set, moving it a little bit every time she tried to open the window until one time she opened it and no one showed up outside to make sure she was okay. Now, she slid the magnet to the correct spot, manually undid the window, and lifted Muskrat carefully out. She climbed out after, pulling the frame closed behind her. Muskrat chuffed and started off along the path to the edge of the palace, and Teresa followed behind. It had been too long. It was time to go see Timothy. She'd found the secret tunnel almost a year before. It was hidden by a rock and a group of ornamental trees. She'd initially thought it might have been dug out by some local animal. There was a kind of underground wasp that left holes that looked similar to it when they died and their hives collapsed. It had turned out to be part of a flood relief system to make sure the gardens never drowned in heavy rain. It led under the walls of the state building compound and into a small field beyond. Intellectually, she knew that a normal girl might not have gone down the tunnel with the spearmint smell of broken ground and the thin coat of slime. She had pushed through easily, joyfully even, and a few dark moments later had found herself on the far side of the perimeter and free for literally the first time in her life. She'd gone walking, exploring, discovering, engaging in developmentally appropriate rebellion, and, most importantly, she'd made her first real friend. Animals had made the path she and Muskrat followed through the forest. Bone elk and ground pigs and pale, shovel-faced horses, none of which had any relationship to Sol system elk or pigs or horses. She walked down the path, her hands in her pockets. Muskrat bounded through the dappled shade, barking at sunbirds and smiling a wide, tongue-lolling grin when they hissed back. It had been too long since she'd been to see Timothy, and she'd had too much she wanted to talk with him about. It wouldn't all fit in her head at the same time. The forest at the edge of the state building thickened at first, the gloom growing around her, and then the land began to rise. She started feeling her breath get deeper, and it felt good.
Before long, the path led out of the trees entirely and into a clearing at the skirt of the mountain. She knew from her studies that the mountain wasn't natural, but a kind of artifact of some long-forgotten alien.